Hey, if you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon as low as $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Use promo code STUFF20 to receive $20 off your first month for listening to this podcast. Switch now at Visible.com. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. The Visible monthly rate is $25 per month. Hey, everybody, if you've been looking for love at first sight, it's closer than you think. It can be found at your local shelter. So this June 7th to June 9th, join the Pedigree Adoption Drive, and the Pedigree brand will reimburse your dog adoption fees nationwide. Pedigree knows that bringing a dog into your home not only opens their heart, it can open yours too. Visit pedigree.com/adoption-drive to learn more and see full terms and conditions.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark, and there's Charles W. Chuck Bryant, and that makes us Stuff You Should Know, the podcast.
I've been working on my Africana accent.
Was that it?
Sort of. I've also been told by some people, Chuck, we love your accents because they're kind of bad, but they're funny. And other people said, my God, please don't ever do accents again.
Oh, you got to keep doing accents.
Of course. People can't tell me what to do.
I think your Afrikaner is a little rough around the edges, especially compared to your Italian.
Well, sure. That's easy, though.
But
that's no problem.
So do you want to say a word in Afrikaner? I think I know that you know one.
Apartheid?
Yes. And it means apartness in Afrikaner.
In Afrikaans.
Yes.
Sure. Which is the language.
Yeah. Well, where did I get Afrikaner?
That is the person is an Afrikaner.
Okay, gotcha.
And they speak Afrikaans.
So in Afrikaans, apartheid means apartness. And you capitalize it. And the reason you capitalize it is because for about 50 years, a little less than 50 years, it was a national policy in South Africa. And it was brutal.
Yeah.
And awful. And the whole world said, you know what, South Africa, we judge you, and for good reason.
Yeah, I remember being a kid, and we'll get to this later, but the Artist Against Apartheid was the first time I ever heard that word.
Yeah.
As a young teenager, Bono telling me, don't play Sun City.
Sun City was built in 81.
Okay, Sun City, first of all, is a resort in South Africa, and, you know, little Steven Van Zandt of The Sopranos and the E Street Band wrote the song called I Ain't Gonna Play Sun City. Got all these people to sing on it, sort of in the We Are the World era.
It was like U2 to Curtis Blow to Africa Bombada to Peter Gabriel.
Dude, like so many people were on that song.
All of these. Miles Davis was on there.
Yeah.
Like everybody was on there. It was a good song.
Yeah.
It was a goodish song.
It was okay.
But it was like I Ain't Gonna Play Sun City. And not only was it a song, but it was like a
movement.
And an agreement, like a creed that you were kind of signing.
Yeah. So who played? I saw that Elton John and Queen and Linda Ronstadt played during apartheid.
Sinatra played? I mean, yeah, they knew ahead of time that there was like a, you know, Sun City was not a good place to be.
Huh.
And it was in apartheid. It was a good place to be if you were in a pro-apartheid South African with a lot of money, because it was a very nice resort.
Yeah, and you wanted to gamble.
And they would get big name acts, but if you went there and played there and made money there, even if you didn't make money there, actually, the UN had an anti-apartheid unit, and they kept track of who was playing there, and they would publish a blacklist.
Huh.
And there was a huge, huge backlash against it. Most people were just like, "Sorry, sorry. If you said it publicly, I'm very sorry that I went and played Sun City.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to go to apartheid South Africa again." As a performer, they would take you off the list.
Oh, okay.
But it was still like it really smacked of McCarthyism because they used a blacklist for suspected communists in the entertainment industry. And this is the same thing.
Yeah, but in this case,
they were on the side of right. The blacklisters were. But yeah, so if you went to Sun City, you ended up on this list. And actually, really interestingly, Tim Reed, Venus Flytrap, he went down to South Africa with Howard Hessman, Johnny Fever.
Of WKRP in Cincinnati.
Because WKRP in Cincinnati was a really huge hit down there.
Really?
Yeah. So they had Venus and Johnny Fever come down. And Tim Reed was one of the first African Americans invited to apartheid South Africa to not perform. Like, this was just a publicity tour.
Right.
And he spent the whole time speaking out against apartheid.
Good.
And he still ended up on the UN's blacklist.
Really?
Because he received like a per diem or something during his publicity tour there. And he spoke out. There's a Chicago Tribune article from the time, from like 1986, that interviews him. And he is a really smart guy speaking out against this blacklist, or at the very least, like how clumsy it was that they weren't using a scalpel at all. They were just like, oh, you went to South Africa and they gave you some money and now you're blacklisted.
Right.
He's like, I was speaking out against apartheid. Like, what are you doing? So let's talk apartheid. Where did this come from, Chuck? I mean, it was instituted in 1948, but it was way older than that.
Yeah. Racial suppression was going on sort of from the 17th century on in Africa,
right,
or at least in southern Africa. And it wasn't South Africa at the time, we should point out. We'll get to that, though.
Yeah.
But the Dutch came there in the 17th century just as a little stop-off station they wanted to set up on the spice route.
Yeah.
Dutch East India Company, they were like, we need a place to kick back a little bit and rest on this trip.
Right.
And so I was about to say, they said, do you mind? I don't think they asked.
No, they did not.
They just sort of set up shop there, and they were not there to colonize. Initially.
No, it was just to set up a way station.
Yep, just to set up a station. And, but the, because they were Europeans, they did bring, along with them the thought that white people are supreme to black people.
Right. And to prove it, they brought along black slaves with them.
That's right. So that notion is immediately set up like, hey, we're better than you.
Right.
You can't tell us what to do. We have guns and, we're more quote unquote advanced if you follow along those European lines of what advanced is.
Right. And because they were Europeans during the Age of Exploration, they said, let's colonize anyway. Let's do it.
That's true.
So they did. And they started setting up settlements that weren't united, but were basically the Dutch, and then later on the British, and to a much lesser extent the French, basically saying, just undergoing a land grab that involved basically taking land from the indigenous people there. And then setting up farms.
Sounds like another country.
Yeah, it sounds really familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah, they basically would try and negotiate for land, and if that broke down, they were like, all right, we're taking it.
Right, and then they would take the land, turn the land into plantations, start growing stuff for export, and then the people would say, we're starving out here. And the Dutch people would say, well, come on in and work for us for like next to nothing. At the very least, you'll live long enough to till our fields.
Yeah.
And that's how the whole thing began.
Yeah, basically they would end up tilling the fields that they at one point owned themselves or used themselves as slaves.
Right.
And this was the Dutch at first until about the mid-1700s. Then British activity picked up in the region. And at the time it was, I think you said, just like various separate societies, farming, live in agrarian lifestyle, ranching, hunter-gathering.
Right.
And then the Dutch and then the Brits came down there with their own slaves and took the land and said, you know what, we're going to battle with each other over this area. And eventually Britain gained control in the early 19th century from the Dutch even. But the Dutch were still there sort of running things. Is that how it worked?
Yeah, there were way more Dutch settlers than British, but the British had managed to gain control of it. Now it was a British colony.
And they said, but slavery is not legal.
No, but you can be, you are a servant.
Basically.
Yeah. And we're going to codify this. And now, for the first time in this area, blacks were legally subservient to whites.
Yeah, so instead of master slave, it was master servant.
Right.
Big diff.
And even though it was a British colony, it was still basically run and operated by the Dutch.
That's right.
And some Dutch didn't like that, so they pressed further and further inward, and ultimately creating more and more of an area for the future South Africa by dominating these tribes with guns, germs, steel, you know, that whole thing.
Yep.
And then around about 1860, something really big happened a little bit into the interior. They discovered diamonds and gold, and they said, oh, we're staying.
Yeah, and they said, you know, we know you love farming and all that good stuff, but we think you'd be much happier working in a mine for next to nothing.
At the very least, it would make us happier if you were working in our mines.
That's right. And you know what? We're going to brutalize you. We're going to segregate you. We're going to give you the most dangerous jobs.
Yeah.
and humiliate you and do cavity searches. And you know what? Now you have to have a passbook to go to your job as a miner, and you're going to be paid a lot less. And the passbooks, the reason we mentioned that is it soon became a staple that you couldn't go anywhere. You weren't supposed to go without a passbook.
Right. It was
initially started as a work thing, though.
In the mines of South Africa, that's where apartheid was born. And a lot of the apartheid techniques, like you say, passbooks, and just the general degradation of blacks in South Africa area, it all began. I mean, it was already in place, but just the brutality of it, I take it, really picked up in the mines.
Yeah, for sure.
So that was, what, the 1860s?
Yeah.
And that was pretty much the way it was. It was a British colony in South Africa. It wasn't South Africa yet, but it was a British colony. The Dutch were ruling it. The blacks there, the African, the indigenous natives, were on the losing end of all of this in a very brutal fashion. And then in the early 1900s, in I think 1908, the people who were running this British colony, the Dutch, said, "Hey, man, we want a little more authority here."
Yeah, and they were, at this point, they were Afrikaner. Like,
right.
In the past century, they had changed a lot. They had this weird hybrid language that developed, and they were Dutch in heritage, but they were starting to become a new people in Southern Africa, which is Afrikaner.
They probably felt about as Dutch as, like, you and I feel British.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that's a good point.
But yeah, so yeah, they were like a whole new group. But the basis of this was that they were a whole new group who had grown up in charge of another group.
Yeah.
And they wanted to make sure that they had a free hand in dealing with these other subclasses. And also, I want to say, like, anytime you hear me say subclasses, I'm making air quotes, everybody.
Yeah, and when I say big difference between master-slave and master-servant, I was being sarcastic.
Right.
We're anti-apartheid.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So these Afrikaners running the show sent a new constitution to Britain, and Britain said, "Okay, go ahead. We're going to go ahead and grant this. It's going to be called the South Africa Act of 1910." And with that, British decreed that the state of South Africa was born.
That's
still
right.
British colony, mm-hmm. but it was officially under Afrikaner control.
That's right.
And one other thing: black people can't hold office ever.
Yeah, that's like the first of what would be many, many, many restrictions.
And that's a huge one, because all of a sudden you have an all-white government made up of white people who feel that it is their white man's burden to keep you from being shiftless and lazy and thieving and just killing yourselves and cutting off your own hands and killing one another. It's up to the white man to make sure you don't do that. And we're going to keep you safe by subjugating you. And the first way we're going to do that is to just have an all-white government.
That's right. And the second thing we're going to do is we're going to take your land, because even though we only make up 20% of the population as white people, we need 93% of the land. So we're going to shuffle 80% of the people onto 7% of the land. Really crappy land.
Really bad land with really
ocean
bad
front.
Housing.
And that was under the leadership of General Louis Botha,
mm-hmm.
first Prime Minister of South Africa, and the Native Lands Act of 1913 basically was when they said, you know what, we're going to move all these communities. If we kill you along the way or you die, no big deal. If your whole life is disrupted, no big deal. And we're essentially going to shove you onto these tiny parcels of crappy land.
Yeah.
So that began what's called the segregation period.
Right.
You can't go here. This is white land.
Right. During the segregation period between the 1913 Lands Act and the 50s or 1948, a bunch of other things happened for the blacks who came to be called Bantus, indigenous Africans. They lost the right to vote in the 30s.
Yep.
In the 20s, they had lost the right to unionize.
Yeah.
And basically, they were just being pushed further and further out of a meaningful participation in society.
Yeah, they tried to hamper their access to education even early on, and fired them from jobs, even if they were totally more skilled than a white worker.
Yeah, if you were a skilled craftsman and you had apprenticed, you couldn't you couldn't carry out your craft any longer.
No.
But legally, they could go in and be like, you know what? There's a white guy who we think is better for this job, so you're fired.
Yeah, because that was the government.
Right. And this was even before the Afrikaner Nationalist Party. This is before apartheid, officially.
Yeah, that didn't come around until 1948.
1948, when, again, with an all-white government that had been in power for 35 years, this extreme right-wing, basically a fringe movement, the Afrikaner Nationalist Movement, came to power, and they officially instituted what we call apartheid, their apartheid policy, starting in 1948, but really kicking off in 1950 with the Population Registration Act, right?
Yeah, and this was under Prime Minister D.F. Malan at the time. And with the Population Registration Act is when they created officially the Bantu, like you said, and named the indigenous black population. So there's Bantu, there's white, and then there's colored, which is mixed race.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to register yourself and be legally classified as one of these three races.
Everyone was.
Everybody. If you're white, good news for you.
Yeah, because you got 93% of the land.
Yeah, if you're Bantu or mixed race, then bad luck for you.
Right. And then at first, Indians were left out. And Indians, I guess because it was a British colony.
Yeah.
Since India was also a British colony, South Africa was kind of a place to be for Indians, including Gandhi, who was one of the early protesters of this segregationist idea, and was imprisoned for, I think, 20 years in South Africa.
Yeah, he was.
Or he was imprisoned while he was there for 20 years. He spent part of it in prison for protesting segregation.
Peacefully, of course.
But then, ultimately, Indians were excluded as foreigners, but then just to keep problems from happening or just to keep the bureaucracy going, they were added as a fourth race.
That's right.
All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on!
Hey, everybody, it's time you heard about Squarespace. Squarespace has the tools you need to create and sell your own website. Whether it's an online course or custom merch, Squarespace has you covered.
That's right. Courses is a great program. You can start with a professional layout that fits your brand, upload video lessons to teach techniques and skills, and tailor your course with a powerful Fluid Engine editor.
That's right. With Fluid Engine, which is a next-generation website design system, by the way, it's never been easier for anyone to unlock unbreakable creativity.
That's right. And don't forget the commerce side, because after that, you can charge a one-time fee or you can even sell a subscription.
Yeah. So turn your creativity into income with Squarespace courses. And right now, go to squarespace.com/stuff for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code STUFF to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Squarespace.
You could not get married between races. If you were Bantu and loved with someone of mixed race, you couldn't even marry them. It's very restrictive. And then next came another act called the Group Areas Act. And this really escalated the segregation because now you needed passbooks, essentially passports, to go from one area to another. Some you weren't even allowed in. And that even went further in the Bantu Homelands Act of 1951, which basically said, you know what, wherever your area is in South Africa, that is now your homeland, and you're not even South African anymore.
Yeah, if you're Bantu, you live in this area. If you're a Bantu married to a colored person, the your colored spouse lives in a different area.
Yeah.
Your family's just ripped apart now.
Well, they took away, basically, they said, you're not even South African.
Right.
We're allowing you to stay here, basically, if you stay in this one area that your passbook says that you can stay in.
Right, because you can't stay here because you're no longer a member of this country.
Unbelievable. Like, I drew exclamation points next to that one just because, like, they literally moved in, took over these people, and then said, you're not even a part of this country
right.
that we have established.
So they've been pushed out of participation in society. Anybody who is not white is now forced onto a reservation.
Yeah, essentially.
And then they really kind of started indoctrinating the next generation with the Bantu Education Act of 1953.
Yeah.
And basically, if you were Bantu, you would be put into a school where the student-teacher ratio was about 56-1 on average. You went to school 3 hours a day.
Yeah.
They did it in two shifts. A teacher would see two different classes, 3 hours for one, 3 hours for another. And you would be taught basically how, like the history of your people was that you were kind of dumb and mm-hmm. meandering and you hadn't really done anything with the land before and, how you were reliant on the white people who came to rescue you and your people.
Yeah.
You were taught how you could work in a factory and that's about as good as it got for you.
Yeah.
And basically they were taught to be servile and better servants to the white, Afrikaners.
Yeah. Well, that was the plan at least.
Yeah.
But it backfired because in the 1950s and 60s, instead of becoming more docile, mm-hmm. they rallied and became, more upset, and basically raged against the machine in the 1950s and 60s at the same time that the U.S. civil rights movement was going on. The same thing was kind of starting to happen in South Africa, and yeah. it was the beginning of what would be a, 30-year end of apartheid.
Yeah.
I guess you could say.
Yeah.
People got mad.
Yeah, and rightly so.
Yeah, and this wasn't just indigenous people. There were also white liberals at the time, just like here in the U.S., that were very much against apartheid and also, suppressed when they tried to, raise awareness.
Right.
Or fight back.
Right, because one of the things about the apartheid government, it wasn't just racial segregation. They were, like I said, extremely right-wing, and they were very much into isolationism.
Yeah.
They kept a very tight control over what their population, white or non-white, mm-hmm. Had access to as far as the news went.
Oh, yeah. Music.
Music. Have you seen Searching for Sugar Man?
Yeah.
It's a good one. And it was, you saw what they did with, there was a song on his record.
Rodriguez, yeah.
And, they scratched the song, the vinyl, so yeah. it couldn't be played. They did stuff like that.
You guys should see that. It just won the Academy Award.
Yeah.
And, we don't want to spoil anything though, because it unfolds in a really great, mysterious way.
But it's a good documentary.
It's a great documentary, and that's what inspired this decision to do this, actually.
Right. So the government was fairly close to totalitarian. Like, if you dissented against the government, white, black, otherwise,
yep.
you would go to jail. But despite this, and despite the brutality that the police were engaged in, there was a strike in 1946. 75,000 unarmed black miners went on strike. A peaceful protest.
Yeah.
1,000 people were killed by the police.
Yeah, they would just open fire on crowds.
Yeah, so this
even,
is...
Like peaceful crowds even.
Right. And this is one of the reasons why I think people were so resistant to being indoctrinated into apartheid mentality. In part because of the brutality of the police tactics, too.
Yeah.
But so let's talk about this. In the 60s, like you were saying, when the U.S. civil rights movement was really starting to brew and take shape, Nelson Mandela emerged as a member of the African National Congress.
Yeah.
Huge organization. And then there was also the Pan-Africanist Congress.
Yeah.
And they were basically peaceful protest groups that were set up to counter the apartheid philosophy.
Yeah, and like we said, even though it was peaceful, it didn't matter. The Sharpeville Massacre in 1960, 1,000 black Africans left their passbooks at home and said, you know what, we're just going to go to the police station and turn ourselves in because we don't have our passbooks.
Right.
And what are you going to do, process us all? No, they're going to open fire on the crowd, killed 69 people, wounded hundreds,
yeah.
apparently.
Yeah.
And then they said, you know what, we're going to ban public gatherings then.
And they also banned the African National Congress and the Pan-Africanist Congress.
Like, you're all illegitimate now, and Nelson Mandela, you're going to jail.
Well, not yet. Not yet. They drove the Pan-Africanist Congress and the African National Congress.
Well, 1963, he went to jail.
Right, but in 1960, they drove them underground.
Oh, well, yeah.
And as a result, these groups went from being peaceful to becoming, actually, they formed paramilitary wings. And Mandela led the African National Congress's guerrilla wing.
Yeah.
And he actually later on said, yeah, we were guerrillas and possibly terrorists, and like there were human rights violations by my group, and I regret that.
Yeah, but they were good terrorists.
Yeah, right. But
so
yeah.
He was jailed for sentenced to a life in prison and remained in prison for 30 years. And most people, unless you're super young, remember Nelson Mandela, Free Nelson Mandela,
yeah,
being a rallying cry.
Yeah.
Up until like the freaking 80s, which is ridiculous that this was still going on then.
Yeah.
But that's the way it went there. 1976, another protest, peaceful, Soweto. This time it was students, and it was because they were trying to make, Afrikaans the primary language in black upper schools, even though not many of them even spoke it.
Right.
So, what good is that? So they went to protest this, and again,
peaceful protest.
Open fire, two children were killed this time, and it started a bunch of riots, and in the end, 3,000 people, up to 3,000, says between 575 and 3,000, probably depends on who you're asking.
Right.
Were killed by the police.
Yeah. And again, just following the same script that they did with Sharpeville in 1960, the government said, all right, any dissent groups are completely banned
now,
outright. And that included the South African Students Organization, led by a guy named Steve Biko.
Yeah.
And Steve Biko had, he was a medical student. He was like 30, I think, when he died. He had founded what was called the Black Consciousness Movement. And it was basically like, it was teaching African self-worth, countering everything that was taught through the Bantu Education Act and everything you learned in school, African self-reliance, economic self-reliance, and it had spread outside of Africa. He was a pretty big figure, and he was pulled over with a buddy and a bunch of anti-apartheid pamphlets, and the police arrested him. They beat him. They left him with a head wound, and he died of his injuries. And when Steve Biko died, that changed everything.
Yeah, he was detained under the Terrorism Act 83 of 1967, which basically said, if we suspect you of being a terrorist, we can detain you for up to 60 days, and then we can renew that 60 days, by the way, indefinitely, without telling anyone, without releasing who's there. And it was basically a way to make people disappear. Usually, right. If you were detained under this act, you were never heard from again.
Yeah.
And Biko eventually found himself in a coma, and because of torture, and then eventually they said after about 3 weeks, you know, we should probably take this guy to a prison with a hospital at least. Mm. So they threw his naked body in the back of a truck to take him to a hospital, and he died. They said it was a hunger strike. It was actually brain hemorrhage from being beaten upside the head.
Yeah.
And years later, Denzel Washington would play him in Cry Freedom.
Nice.
And Peter Gabriel wrote the awesome song Biko.
Yeah. And Tribe Called Quest has Steve Biko's song.
Yeah.
Stir It Up.
Yeah.
So the Soweto uprising and the police killings of those two children was followed right on the heels by Steve Biko's death.
Which was a big deal, like, around the world.
Yeah, it was. The U.S. ambassador to South Africa, I think, and probably what was a huge protest move, went to Steve Biko's funeral. Steve Biko dying was a big deal.
Yeah, and we should shout out to Helen Suzman. Shout out. She was the one voice of reason, in South Africa's all white parliament. She was the one voice, anti-apartheid voice. And she was like, if you look her up today, man, she's an amazing, amazing woman. She just died a few years ago.
Oh, yeah.
But, she was at the funeral. And, this is when it became like a thing around the world. Like, hey, you know what? We're going to start pulling our embassies out of South Africa.
Yeah.
We're going to start boycotting sanctions against South Africa, economic sanctions. And this was happening with the United States, Great Britain, other Western nations. And basically South Africa became, you know, the evil empire, like,
right.
Exposed.
It was pretty cool. By finally in 1986, the U.S. Congress got its act together enough to pass the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act.
Yeah.
And it banned any new investment, any new business setting up and dealing in trade with South Africa. South Africa was banned from doing business here in the U.S., so South African airlines couldn't land at any U.S. airport.
Yeah. Hit them where it hurt, basically.
Yeah, big time. The rand fell in value. It was a big deal. And Reagan vetoed it, actually, and his veto was overridden by Congress.
Awesome.
That's how badly they wanted to do it. And it was a very important thing. This was right in the middle of, this is like when we were kids. You remember that? That Keith Haring, poster of Free South Africa.
Uh-huh.
There was like the Ain't Gonna Play Sun City.
Yep. The song Free Nelson Mandela. I remember that one.
Yeah. It was a big deal.
Yeah.
The whole world was opposed to South Africa. There was this great thing called divestment that actually may have really been the thing that killed apartheid in South Africa.
Yeah. What was the deal there?
So divestment is, and it's going on now, but with apartheid, it was basically where it started with colleges. Colleges have huge endowments
yeah.
that are heavily invested in all sorts of stuff. And they said, you know what? We're not going to invest in anything that has anything to do with South Africa anymore. Coca-Cola, if you're doing business in South Africa, we're not going to invest in you anymore.
Right.
Whoever. And so they divested rather than invested.
Okay.
They got all their money out. And a lot of universities did this. And they did it at the prompting of some of their students. Like in Harvard, the students erected a shantytown to show what the people who lived in the shantytowns in South Africa were living like.
Wow.
And got all these endowments to start divesting. And I think, Cal had the biggest one. They divested $3 billion from the South African economy.
Holy cow.
And, they think that was the thing that really like open the bleeding.
Go Bears.
Yeah. So this divestment combined with this international political pressure all over the world, and South Africa still says, go to hell. We're not getting rid of apartheid. For years still.
Yeah.
And
through the 80s.
Yeah. And then finally it was what, 1993?
Well, 1989 is when the big turning point came. That's when F.W. de Klerk became president apartheid South Africa. And between 89 and 93 is when he basically repealed everything on the books and said, this is going in a different direction now.
Yeah.
Let's release Nelson Mandela. And in fact, when we have our first democratic election in 1994, Nelson Mandela wins. So what a great ending to that story.
It really is.
And, despite being in prison for 30 years, on May 10th, 1994, when Mandela was giving his speech, he closed by speaking in Afrikaans.
This is his inauguration speech.
Yeah, which is like, the fact that he even spoke in that tongue, to me, it says a lot about the man. And he said, what is past is past. And here's a Nobel Peace Prize, Mr. Mandela,
right.
and Mr. de Klerk.
Yeah.
Like, you both get it in 1993. And I like the article pointed out, it was a shockingly peaceful transition. And I'm sure there are still many, many more years that are needed for the healing. You don't get over something like that overnight if it's been hundreds of years. But I think things are definitely headed in the right direction now.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that they did was they set up a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was like basically a tribunal that heard stories of human rights violations. It gave victims a voice to say it in public, like, this happened to me.
Right.
In some instances, people who perpetrated these could be prosecuted.
Wow.
They could also be forgiven publicly by this court, this tribunal. It was a really good move to, like, kind of help this national healing. Because, yeah, all of a sudden, apartheid's gone over a four-year period.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there was a lot of people who were kind of into that. And they did a lot of stuff, and they're not protected by the government anymore. And, like, a lot of bad things happen to a lot of people who are still alive. Like, what do you do?
Yeah.
And I think that was a really good move to move not just the government, but also the society to a post-apartheid life.
Yeah. I'd like to hear from people in South Africa about the state of things today.
Yeah.
And watch Searching for Sugar Man, people.
Yes.
It really, like, through this great story of music encapsulates this whole time period really, really well.
Right. And then I guess ever since the aliens landed over Johannesburg, that's kind of taken up a lot of their a lot of their attention.
Oh, yeah. What was that?
District 9.
Yeah, which was really based on apartheid pretty much, wasn't it?
What?
Was that the inspiration for that movie?
That was a good movie.
Yeah, so watch that. Watch District 9, Searching for Sugar Man, and watch Cry Freedom.
Yeah.
And
go listen to Tribe Called Quest, Peter Gabriel, Little Steven.
I have not listened or seen the rugby movie yet.
Oh,
where Morgan Freeman plays Mandela with
Invictus or
Mitt Damon.
Yeah. What is it?
Invictus, I think?
Yeah.
Yeah, I need to see that one.
Okay, that's it for apartheid, huh? Thank goodness. Do you want to do a word from our sponsor?
Yeah, we got listener mail coming up, but word from our sponsor first.
All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
So now it's time for listener mail, right?
That's right. Josh, I'm going to call this Surf's Up. I just listened to How Surfing Works as someone who surfs 300 days a year
Wow. All
over the world and teaches surfing for a living. Just wanted to say that you guys did an excellent job. For two guys who don't surf and have very limited experience with it, your definitions and descriptions were pretty much spot on. And I would have to agree with you, Chuck, that it is very difficult to learn. It has one of the slowest, most miserable learning curves of any sport. I always tell people that if you don't enjoy sucking at it, then you won't enjoy surfing. So, quickly, did you surf on your vacation?
Yeah, I did.
And how did you do?
I've been waiting to ask. I got up. Yumi was watching from the shore, and she agrees that I did get up at least once.
Okay.
She says possibly twice, but I only stand by one. And by get up, I mean I was virtually crouching.
Sure.
And then fell off after like 5 seconds.
And how many days did you try it?
Just one. And I didn't even take a lesson.
Okay, you just went out there.
Do you know how?
Well, our podcast.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's how I figured out how to do it. I did, kind of, but I remember we were talking about how it's very easy to like get on your hands and knees and then get up.
Yeah.
But you don't want to learn that technique.
Is that the technique?
That's what I learned, yeah.
Sure. Yeah. You got to crawl before you can walk.
Exactly.
Also, I should clear up that in general, learning to surf on a longboard is usually preferred as they catch waves easier and are easier to stand up on than a shortboard. But being that catching a wave is the hardest part for beginners, you're usually better off learning that way.
Yeah.
Did you have a shortboard?
Yeah, it was shortish.
Shortish.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't a longboard.
They turn easier, but turning is pointless if you can't catch the wave in the first place.
Right.
So
yeah,
anyway.
There was no turning going on.
Yeah.
It was surf riding.
Surf riding. Anyway, I just want to say good job, guys. I'll be teaching surfing all summer in Southampton, New York. If you're up in New York this summer, hit me up. I'll take you out for a surf. And that is Miles from Santa Cruz. P.S. Big Wednesday is the best movie ever. Of course you think that. Because that's what surfers do.
That's nice. Miles?
Yeah.
300 days a year? Can you believe that?
It sounds like Miles has got a pretty decent life if he's living in Santa Cruz and then teaching in New York in the summers.
Yeah, that's cool. Thanks for writing in, Miles. If you are an expert or you do something that we've talked about 300 days a year, we want to hear from you because it pretty much makes you an expert. You can tweet to us at SYSK Podcast. You can join us at facebook.com/stuffyoushouldknow. You can send us an email, right? Isn't that what those are called?
Yeah.
To stuffpodcast@discovery.com. And check out our website, stuffyoushouldknow.com. apartheidsoftheearth.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Are you thirsty? Well, Richard's rainwater is caught clean before it even hits the ground. Rain is naturally pure, so there's no need for harsh chemicals or additives. Richard's rainwater contains no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing. Enjoy the smooth, clean taste of still rainwater or the cold pressured bubbles of sparkling rainwater. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. That's richardsrainwater.com. And for a coupon, text STUFF to 251-292-8887 and receive $2 off a 12-pack case of Richard's Rainwater.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.